talking about children, I think we actually are on page 33. And I really thought we buzzed through this lesson last week, so I'm expecting we're going to finish it this week, but we didn't last week, so who knows?
We are passionate about our children.
We are passionate about our children. Just briefly, when she says, are you planning your child's future? We talked about that last week, but I think that is probably, at least for a Christian mother, and surely for any mother, that's what you think about the most. You don't spend all your time thinking about what you want from them as a 2-year-old or a 7-year-old. It's how do you want them to live their life? Because we're so aware that we have them for such a short time. You know, they're just here, and then they're out on their own. And what are we providing for their future? So I think, as we talked about, that's got to be our most important focus and plan. And it has to, everybody here has older kids, that except the people that don't have kids at all. You have little kids. You're the last one here with little kids. It's so hard sometimes when they get to that age where they say, I hate you. I hate everything you do. How could you do this to me? It's really hard because you don't want your kids to hate you. So it's a real important time to remember, if you do, you do, and maybe you'll get over it. But what I'm doing for you is what you need. And, Cole told me last night, kind of out of the blue, we had a real good day, and he said, you're not mean. Thanks. Not sure where that came from, but okay. I'm glad I'm on the positive side.
Today.
Yes. Right now. He didn't feel that way about me by bedtime. He had a total meltdown. So.
My kids used to tell me I was a mean old mama.
Yeah.
Mine did too.
Yeah.
And I said, but I love you.
Yeah. And it's really important that we're able to separate some of those feelings out, because everybody likes people to like them. Mm-hmm. Very few people truly don't care if nobody likes them. So it's they know it hurts, and that's why they say it. That's the point. So
when mine would say that they hated me, I'd say, well, you don't have to like me. But right. You do have to obey me.
Right.
I just told me, yeah, I'm the meanest mama you ever had. So just go do what I told you to do.
That's right.
Just wait.
So, enough of that. Under the choose you this day, I think that's such a powerful verse. Choose you this day, and you will serve. Because it is a choice. You know, none of us has to serve God. And none of us serve God by accident. It's a choice. And we can choose to follow God, or we can choose to be in the world, follow Satan. And very few people would acknowledge that they're following the devil. That would, first of all, some of them will tell you there's no devil. And then the others will say, no, of course I'm not. But if you're not following God, you are indeed following the devil. And that's a statement that most people don't want to acknowledge. They don't want to hear. I got to fix this thing. It's driving me crazy.
Shorter trip than usual this morning?
No, I just forgot to put that on there. I always put it on there because it always drives me crazy.
Just talk about the crazy.
Short trip. About the same.
Same trip.
About the same crazy. Added by the 2 little boys overnight. Choose you to stay whom you will serve. And I think it's important to note that for most of the time when you see that scripture quoted, the middle part's taken out. Choose you to stay whom you will serve. Whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorite in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And I think taking the middle part out makes it easier for kids to remember, but I also think it takes out a really important piece, because it's saying, if you're not serving God, this is who you're serving. And it reminds us that it's never it's never that you're not serving somebody. It's one of the two. And I think a whole lot of people want to think they can be in the middle. Well, I'm not serving God, but I'm not serving the devil. But we are. Okay, people who live in glass houses. Why is that the subtitle of this little part?
Because
What's the saying, Laura?
Because you can say, you know, do as I do, not or do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, how well does that work?
Yeah. I was going to say, I heard a very interesting analogy of in a study last week. They were saying, people don't look as God as their father. They want him to be like a grandfather, let you get away with murder. And they forget the father is forever watching, keeping control mm-hmm. over you. Or the grandfather just kind of wants to be your friend.
Right.
And it's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah. And I've heard it referred to, too, as the, kind of the Santa Claus effect. I'll ask for something, he'll give it to me, and my life will be good. Without understanding the obligation we have and the love and desire to do what's best for us that God has. Because what's best for us is not always what we want. Even as adults, even working our way through the world. You know, I don't know how the Holy Spirit works in our lives. I believe he does. We're told he does. I just don't understand exactly when it happens. But I know that when I spent a couple of years trying to get that job in Austin, never could get anybody to hire me. And then when I wound up moving here, and it put a series of events started happening, and my brother died, and all these things happened, and I thought, I don't think my parents could have survived. I've always been the kid at home. You know, Mike and Susan left, but I've always been the kid here. I don't think they could have survived Mike's death and my move. Was that an operation that God did? And he said, no, you're not going to Austin. Forget it. I don't know. But that's how it feels to me.
The providence
of God. That he, and again, I can't explain how he works in our lives, but I know he does. Otherwise, why are we praying? What's the point if God doesn't work in our lives? It's in some level somehow that only he understands. But
Jim, what I thought of when I read this section was what the people were told about the Pharisees. Do as they say, not as
right.
they do.
Right.
Heavy burdens.
And the Pharisees
don't lift a finger to help. That's
right. Move to the other side of the road. Don't do anything of service. Don't do anything of value. But look righteous. Look pious. Make sure people see you praying and hear you saying things like, thank you, Lord, that I'm not him. I think hypocrisy is probably the most deadly thing for the church. And you hear it all the time. You'll hear people say, well, I'm not going to go to church there. It's filled with hypocrites. That's a stupid argument because the world has hypocrites. People can be hypocrites. In any group of people, you have about the same statistical probability of having some hypocrites. It doesn't matter. So it's not reason. But you hear people say that. And I do think hypocrisy can kill someone's interest in the Lord very, very quickly. So we have to be that shining light. We're told we're the light of the world, we're the salt of the earth. We have to be an example. And the old saying about people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. You get a stone thrown back at you, and what happens to your glass house? Shatters. So when we are doing things we shouldn't do, and yet saying, do this, this, or this, it's going to come back on us, and it's going to fail in our efforts that we're trying to teach or trying to get our children to do whatever it is we're going to do. Now, does that mean we can't make mistakes?
But that's what people in the world call hypocrisy, or our errors.
Right.
So I don't think you can win that one. And all you can do is to say, yeah, there are.
There are hypocrites.
There are, yes, there are.
In every group of people that you meet, there's going to be some statistical probability of finding a hypocrite.
Yes.
People who make mistakes are not hypocrites. They are people.
But that's how they're related.
Yes, but I think that's where we can do teaching. Yes. Because I have family members who've tried to pull that one on me. And because they are family members, I can say things like, so you're perfect. You don't make any mistakes ever. Well, I didn't say that. Well, then, yes. According to your definition, then you're a hypocrite. But you're not a hypocrite. You're mistaken. And that's a difference. Laura?
I was going to say, I think a good example of this one is that lady who committed adultery, and they were all picking up stones to throw at her. And Jesus said, you know, he is without sin. Okay. Because they couldn't see it. They just saw her great
one. Right. Right.
And you forget to look at yourself. Check yourself first, kind of thing.
Well, you know that old saying, if you're pointing a finger, you need to know what's pointing back at you. And I don't think we can be without sin, but I certainly think we better be moving that direction as fast as we can and striving for that at all times. And as we get older, shouldn't we logically be without sin, or certainly with less, as we grow in the Word and know what we're doing? Shouldn't we be able to correct some of those things that we did when we were younger? And I used to know a man that said, yes, if you live long enough and you work at it long enough, this guy, he said, you can be perfect. I have a little trouble with that. But his statement was, the Bible says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, but not that you're continuing to do it. He said, you can get past that. If you live long enough and work hard enough, you can get to the point where you don't sin. I'm
most
not sure.
Most of the time.
And I'm not sure, but what that's a pretty self-important sin.
There's a big difference in a sin and a life of sin.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And certainly.
And maybe that's what he meant.
I like to think so.
And that was the difference in Judas and Peter.
Yes. Yes. Peter made plenty of mistakes.
And Paul.
Sinned. Yeah. But Peter kind of kept doing them. Took him longer.
Which is my comfort,
comforting
night.
To me.
And David.
A man of God.
Yeah.
And Samson.
After God's own
heart. Here we go. We're just here.
And even though we don't know what Paul's sins are, Paul said that he does the very thing he wishes he wouldn't.
Right.
So, I mean, he's
called himself the chiefest of sinners. Mm-hmm. So, it is a struggle for us all. And
Paul listed them.
And if we feel like we are past sin, I think that's a very, very dangerous place to live. Because you start...
The minute you stop growing, you start growing back.
Right. You stop growing, and you start glossing over what you've done. Well, that wasn't all that bad. That wasn't...
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
I don't have to repent now.
Right. So, that whole glass houses thing, and of course, this talking about it here in relationship to our children. If we, and the example we use all the time, I know in a lot of denominations, and sometimes in the church, but not very often, because people will call you on it, people will drop their children off for Sunday school, and they know they go on and go back and pick them up. I don't know any child that by the age of about 6 or 7 wouldn't be going, wait, why am I there if you're not there? They don't have to be very old to figure that out. Probably 6 or 7, they've had it figured out for 2 or 3 years. Because you're telling me I need to go and I need to hear and I need to understand and I need to do what's being said there. But you're home watching football or whatever. Doesn't apply. Kids are much brighter than that.
There's a family in Florida where we used to worship where the little girls got their daddy to go to church for that very reason. And Mama was bringing them every week, and he wasn't coming. He's not a Christian. Mm-hmm. And he started coming because they influenced him.
Mm-hmm. So, watch your diet, it says. One is like a pitcher pouring its contents out constantly, will run out if it's never taken away by itself and refilled. I do think that can be a problem, particularly for young mothers. You're so busy. There's so much going on. I'll read my Bible later. I'll do some study later. And by the time it gets to be later, you're too tired to do it. I'll do it in the morning. And we have to take the time to fulfill our own spiritual needs. And I think as women, we tend to spend so much of our time doing for others that we forget sometimes that we have a need to refill ourselves. I just heard that and thought, I don't think I've turned mine. And then we assume our children will understand, that they'll catch our beliefs like a virus. Well, just sink into their skin somehow. But it's not true. I like where she says a 4-year-old didn't know the name of the first man in the Bible. What? How did that happen? Because we assume, and we're not spending that time in educating our own children spiritually. We assume they're getting it at Bible class, or that they just know. Sometimes when you know something, almost always, if you know something, it's hard for you to, if you know it so deeply, it's hard for you to imagine that someone else doesn't know it. Roger's a car guy. And he wants to come in and talk to me about what he's doing on that car. And he'll say, well, you know, the carburetor does it. I said, what does the carburetor do? And he looks at me like, how do you not know what a carburetor does? Because it's so much part of him.
Because we don't have them these days.
He does on a 1976 Pinto station wagon that's in my garage.
And he adjusts it regularly.
Sure. But you can add any car part in there you want to add. I don't know. I don't know anything about cars. I don't want to know anything about cars. I don't care about cars. If they move me from point A to point B on a successful, regular basis, that's all I care about. And that's hard for him to grasp. He has a really hard time understanding that. And we were talking about something the other day. I've been writing some modules, and I can't remember what I said, but casually, I said something about the marital dyad. And he said, what? I said, marital dyad. And he said, two people. So, yeah. Why did you just say two people? I said, I don't know, because when you write in the professional journals, you call it the marital dyad. But he was, yeah, it didn't even make sense to him that you would use that phrase. So some things we just are just a part of us from years and years of time, and we don't even know that the other people don't know it. I don't know about y'all, but when you talk to your friends in the denominational world, aren't you amazed sometimes that they don't know who certain people are? That they've never heard of, to pick a name, you know? I mean, they might know who Solomon was, they might know the name, but they don't know anything about Solomon. So things that we know so well, we have to be careful that we don't assume our children already know them. We have to be helping and teaching and learning.
Well, and they may have been taught in Bible class, but they may not have been paying attention that day. So
teaching somebody is different from somebody learning. Those are two separate processes.
You have to keep on and on and on. It's not a one-time thing.
Right. It's not a, here's your vaccination. Which would be nice if you could just say it one time and they got it, but none of us do. And you can tell what an old book this is. Every one of our children could probably tell us who Joe Namath is. No. Who? That old guy?
So yes, she's like, who?
Yeah.
Like when I reference, you know, down the street from Johnny Rutherford, I'm like, who?
Yeah, but I know. I know who Johnny Rutherford is.
Kids don't know who Brenda Lee is.
Yeah. So, and I will tell you, this is something we have to remember when we're trying to teach our children, too. We don't have to adapt to the world, but we do have to sometimes adapt language so that they understand what we're saying. Roger made a comment to Kaylee the other night while we were in the car. And she said, what? I said, hey, that's a really old-fashioned term. She has no idea what you're talking about. And I translated it into today's language. And she went, oh, okay. So we can't just assume that children understand what we're telling them. We have to get feedback. It's that whole communication thing. We have to make sure that they heard what we said and that they understand. And when they're reading the Bible, it's real easy sometimes to read words without pulling that information into your head. So we have to stop, we have to quiz, we have to put it into a context where they get it and can consume it.
Well, it's also like starting Bible class at 6 months, and people in the world are just amazed that you're teaching Bible class at that age. They can't learn anything.
Yeah, they can't learn.
But you're teaching them other things at home.
Right.
What's the difference?
Right.
So
absolutely. And they, I've had people say they can't learn anything then. They don't know anything about God. Well, they don't till we teach them, but we're going to teach them.
But repetition,
sure,
week after week,
yep,
they're going to learn it.
They didn't always have that here either.
No.
Mm-hmm. I just kind of remember when it first started, mm-hmm, there was questions about it. Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of people that said, this just babysitting. And I remember being in the fray of that and saying, you don't understand young children. Yeah, it's a nursery, it's babysitting, so parents can go.
But you work hard in that. That's what I teach.
Yeah. And you do work hard.
You work very hard. Sometimes harder than those that have an actual lesson plan. Mm-hmm.
Don't get me started on them fucking lesson plans, or you'll be another hour and a half. We can do those. Should be doing them. In our family, she says on page 36, we have some large flashcards we play with when we're riding the car and teach our children simple Bible facts. But what about the more important concepts? And I think that's maybe where we fail the most. I think we're pretty good about teaching Bible facts. But I have long said that I don't think we do very well in teaching our children the big picture of the Bible. And I like your book, incidentally. But of how it all fits together. If you give them 175,000 facts, but you don't thread them together to let them know why it matters, then you will lose people. Because people will come to the point of age where they say, why should I care about this? Why does this matter? And if they can't understand that from the very beginning, God had a plan to save his people, and that it went through these iterations of how it was done, but it was all the same salvation, that it covered from the beginning of time to the end of time, and that everything that happened was leading up to or away from the cross, I think you will lose people because it doesn't make sense. If you just teach them about the sacrifices of the Old Testament and the laws in Leviticus, where does that fit into our world? It doesn't. But if they can understand that these sacrifices showed their pleasure before God, it showed their willingness to be obedient, sacrifice was required for the removal, or at that point the rolling over of sin, all of these things connect. And I don't think we do a very good job
and then
of teaching
tie it
children.
To the sacrifice of ourselves in Romans.
Right.
Our own.
And then the fruits of the Spirit, needing the fruits of the Spirit to know how to live daily with both our brothers and sisters in Christ and with people in the world.
Right. And how do those fruits of the Spirit exhibit themselves? I mean, we're pretty good about getting that list out there and singing the song, you know. But what do those words mean? What do they mean in your life? What do they mean when you have a run-in with your boss? You know, your boss has done something that's really frustrating and irritating you. What do these fruits of the Spirit mean in that situation? Or when you have a disagreement with a family member or someone at the congregation, what do those words mean to help us know how to live our lives? And I just don't think we're very good at it. I hope we're getting better.
Well, I don't remember if it's this section, but one of them talks about finding the positive things or turning the negative things into positive to talk with our children instead of everything just being negative.
Right. And I think I was pretty bad at that when my kids were little. I hope I've gotten better, but I think I was too willing to say this, you shouldn't do this, instead of how could you turn this around.
One of the words that I use that comes from, you know, our talk is we use the word beatitudes for the things that Jesus said, you know, blessed are those who, and I told my children when they were little, I said, you know, there's a lot of things we're not supposed to do because they're wrong. I said that these are the beatitudes. These are the things you can be,
right.
You know, and that's what we did. It was focused.
Right.
There's so many classes that, you know, I went to or whatever where we focused on memorizing the list of the orders of the kings of Israel.
Right.
Well, why do we do that? So we can show off.
Yeah.
There's no benefit to our spiritual walk to memorize the kings of Israel.
And thank goodness, because I never could.
I never taught my children that.
Yeah.
You know, I did. When I became a young adult, I had been taught facts, but never taught how it was all put together until I became an adult and I learned about the type, the anti-type, and to learn that Joseph was a type of Christ, that study fascinated me. You know, and the study of Melchizedek, which I shared the week that you weren't here, just those kinds of stories make the Bible so much richer to show that God had a plan from the beginning.
Yes, that it's not just a point in time that's not connected, that doesn't make sense.
But the amazing thing about the Bible, though, is each individual story
also has a benefit to us just as it is without understanding its place.
Right, right. They stand independent of
one another.
So it has
a double.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really important when our children are young, that they get those individual stories and individual lessons. And it takes a while to tie them together. But I do think as they become teenagers, we need to be getting those ties in there. We need to be getting them to understand the big picture of what's going on. And why was it important for us to know about Daniel in the lion's den? You know, how does that fit in with the whole thing? Anything else on that section before we move past it? We talked about teaching them the why. So it gets to the, please, mother, I'd rather do it myself. Now, I don't know about your family, but when my children got to this stage, they were not saying, please, mother, I'd rather do it myself. That was not their approach. So I always knew when Kate was mad, I was usually mom. I was mama if she was sick. But when she was annoyed, I was mother.
Yes.
Mother. So.
I don't know when y'all got there, but mine got there real early. I do it myself.
2 or 3. Yeah.
No, she was 15 months old. No, I do it.
I remember Audra.
Yeah.
Because of their growing need for independence, teenagers sometimes find it difficult to wholeheartedly accept their parents' opinions. That's an understatement if I ever heard one. But it is... The thing we have to remember as parents is that need to struggle and find out for themselves is incredibly important for them to become independent, autonomous adults. And that's what we want, because none of us want that 40-year-old kid, and I mean kid in the very real term of that, living at home because they can't live on their own. And so that striving for independence is a painful process for both us and the child who's going through it. Because if you ask any teenager and you catch them at the right time to ask the question, they'll acknowledge that they want to be independent and on their own, and they want to crawl back in the hole and be a little kid. Because making your own decisions and creating your own life is very frightening. And sometimes it feels better to go back to mom and dad and let them do it, which is how the process works, which is why it's so crazy making. Because you never know which day you're waking up on. Are they independent? Are they a little kid? And it's painful for them and painful for us, but a very, very, very necessary process. So when they are rebelling, and I like to use that term while we're talking, in just the questioning and why do I have to do this, as opposed to those kids who choose some actual real rebellion and create problems for themselves. But every kid is going to rebel to some extent because they're trying to break from their parents to become an adult. How they handle it is what we need to be working on as parents. Yes, I understand that you're trying to gain some independence. Yes, I understand you want to make some of your own decisions. And here are the ones you can. And then here are the things you're not ready for. And I hate you. Well, it's okay. I'll live with that if you hate me. But still, here's what's going to happen. So I think we have to help them move to that for their own benefit. I know every one of us has probably said, oh, I just wish they could stay a baby forever. And my mother one time said, and how sad that would be. The child that can't, for a mental or a physical reason, move on, or just because emotionally they never prepared to move on. Because what's cute at 6 isn't cute at 26 or 40. I had a relative, I won't be more specific than that, and I asked his brother one time, I said, how's so-and-so? And he said, well, since he asked to borrow $500 the last time and I haven't seen him, I don't know. And he was one of those that never, he was my favorite cousin when I was growing up. My very, very favorite cousin. Because he was funny and lighthearted and never took anything seriously. And that's so attractive when you're 15 and so unattractive when you're 40. And he stayed there. He never got out of that. So, please, mother, I'd rather do it myself. In working with older children, she's in paragraph 2 here, we can learn a lot by studying the teaching methods of Jesus. One of his frequent means of teaching was to answer a question with a question. When the lawyer in Luke 10 asks, who's my neighbor? snarky little question. Jesus responded with a story and then another question, thus putting the burden of responsibility back on the person who asked the question. Apply this method to yourself. If you were to ask your husband for new carpeting, which you knew in your heart you really couldn't afford, and were actually just a little peeved at him because you couldn't afford it, which would be his better response? You know, we can't afford it. I don't know why you asked. Or, I wish we could. What do you think about that situation? Don't you just take that when it gets turned back on you? You have to make your own decision. I'm sure you've heard me say this before, but I'm going to do it again because it fits here. My dad, as y'all all know, is a very quiet man. He's pretty unflappable. Doesn't get flapped about much. And I remember one time, and I had an allowance growing up, and that allowance increased on a regular basis as my responsibilities for it increased. So while I sometimes had quite a bit of money coming to me, it required a lot going out. So I had this little amount for spending, you know, just pleasure spending. And I went to him one day, I was probably about 16, and I said, I want to go to the movie tonight with my friends. And he said, okay. I said, I don't have any money. He said, don't you get an allowance? I said, well, yeah. He said, well, there you go. And I said, well, it's gone. And he said, that sounds like a personal problem to me. Went out of the room. So, you know, he could have said, I'm not giving you any money. How come? Why didn't you take care of your money? Why, you know? But really, he just let the consequences of my spending habits fix it. He didn't get mad at me. He just said, sorry, can't help you. You had money, you spent it, now you don't have any, so you can't go to the movie. And the more we can do natural consequences with our children, the better off we're going to be, because then it is not us imposing something on them. Now, sometimes you can't wait for the natural consequence to come about because it would be harmful or deadly sometimes. But if one of the things we're always teaching in child development is whatever that punishment, if a child does something, you say, go stand in the corner, it doesn't connect for a little kid on what they did. But if they use the blocks as rockets and the blocks are no longer in their purview, then it makes sense. Oh, I can't do that with blocks because then they go away. I don't get to play with them. So a natural consequence is much more effective for us as humans. If I don't put gasoline in my car and I run out of gasoline and I have to walk to get some, I'm going to look at the gas tank next time. I'm not going to forget that lesson. I'll tell you a very embarrassing story. Stan, cut this out of the thing. We were on vacation. Roger had been driving. We were in our big blue van. And I had been driving. And it was his turn to drive. And I took a nap. And I woke up to find my husband, at the time my 62-year-old husband, pushing the van. Because I had failed to put gasoline in it. We had stopped at a couple of rest stops. So in my brain, you know, we stopped. We didn't stop at gasoline stations. We stopped at rest stops. He's pushing a van. Fortunately, two young men jumped out and said, you know, came over to help him. And there was a gas station right there. I mean, and one kid said, where are we going? And Roger said, I so wanted to say Kentucky. We're going to that gas station. Right there. But I guarantee you, I don't get in the car ever again without looking at that gas tank because I don't want my husband pushing this huge vehicle and having a heart attack. And that was completely my fault. It had gasoline in it when I took over the driving, and it didn't when I quit. That was a natural consequence to my actions. Did he ever raise his voice to me or say that was really stupid? No, never. Because it was enough. I look up and he's pushing this van, and I'm thinking I'm going to kill him by letting him have a heart attack. So the more that we can use natural consequences with our children, the better off we're going to be, because they're going to learn and they won't resent us because we didn't do it. They did it to themselves.
I found it very effective, especially with our daughter, to use others as an example and the consequences of their consequences. Because if you came at it straight on with her, she really was resentful and she really was not going to pay attention. But if he used others, he said, see what happened to her? See what happened to him?
And you're lucky that it worked on Audra. That often doesn't work on kids. And going, well, it can't happen to me.
Yeah.
You know, that teenagers think they're
invincible.
They in their
but
Teflon coat.
For whatever reason. I mean, I think the Lord just let that work because we had all the other things.
You were without any other answers.
Yes, and I was.
Okay, so if we can, and I'm not saying we should spend our time going, oh, that'll make him mad, and I don't want to say that. Because, as I've said before, if they got mad at me, they just got mad at me, and that was okay. But the learning slows down when people are angry or resentful. And so if we can use things that don't let anger and resentment come in, then the learning jumps up. And natural consequences when they're available. And it takes some time to stop and think about it. Because pop on the rear is quicker and more instinctive. But maybe at that particular moment, it's not the best way to teach. I'm not opposed to pop on the rear. Just ask Cole about last night. But there are times that other things are going to be more effective. And we need, as parents, we need to pull back and quit being angry and think about the best way to teach our children.
That's where I struggle the most is my temper sometimes gets in the way. And then I raise my voice before I meant to, and, you know, it gets out of control really fast.
Yeah.
Not me, but the situation.
The situation, you know? It does. Because
they respond in anger, and now they're in trouble again because they've just...
And you haven't really solved the problem of the first issue. So I think it's just really important that we learn to pull back, think about what's going on, and I don't mean we let them get away with what they shouldn't get away with, but sometimes there's a better way to handle it than our first reaction. I know there is for me, because like you, my temper tends to jump up.
A lot of times with my older two, I would just walk away because I could feel it happening, and I knew I was going to respond in a way I shouldn't. And I'd go to my room, and I'd shut the door and lock it and just pray, you know, that I would calm down and I could focus
and
I could deal with it in the right way. And my son would say to me, sure, walk away. That's what you're good at, you know. And it just cut me every time because I wasn't walking away to leave him. I was walking away to control myself.
Right. The important thing, though, is that you come back to the situation.
Which we did.
You can't leave it. And it's tempting to leave it. Everything's calmed down a little bit now. You know, why stir it up again? Well, you're stirring it up again because you haven't taught the lesson yet. And nobody said being a parent was easy. And if anybody knew what it took beforehand, fewer children.
Did you ever want to just act like you didn't see what they were doing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Because I'm just not ready for another exhausting thing.
Please, Lord,
yeah.
No. Yeah.
But you can't.
No.
And, I think that's the thing that until your child is a parent, they don't get. They can't. It's not their fault. They can't get it. You can't get it till you've been in the situation. But the day they call you up and go, Mom, I get it. I understand. Remember that time when I was 15? I get it. I know what you're talking about.
Both of mine have called me and said, we're so sorry.
Yeah. Thank you, Mom.
Thank
you,
Mama. Or they hear your words coming out of their mouth.
That's a funny one. I like that one. And the shock on their face when they hear themselves,
that is gratifying.
She talks on page 38 about try not to say maybe. Unless there's really a reason to say maybe. Can we go to the park in the morning? Well, maybe if it's not raining, we can go. So there's a reason to say maybe. But for the most part, when we say that, we're really just doing it for ourselves. Because we don't want to get into the thing, whatever the thing is. And it's so much easier as a parent, in truth, to just answer the question. There are some things that have to have a maybe. You know, are we going to go on our vacation next week? We think we are. But if, you know, something horrific happens, that's a maybe. It's a till we know for sure. But just, can I go to the movies Friday night? Maybe. Okay. Think to yourself. And I'm not saying you have to say it to your children, but think to yourself, why am I saying maybe? Am I saying maybe because I don't want to deal with the situation? Or because I think and I might be mad at you by then. You know, is there a real reason to say maybe? And you can say yes and then change it if situation changes. You can say, yes, you can go to the movie Friday night. And then something untoward happens and they do something they shouldn't do. And you say, you know, I know you were looking forward to going to the movie, but this situation has changed that answer. You can't go now because you've shown me you're not responsible or whatever. So I don't think we should waffle on our children if we've told them they can do something. But that's not to say there's never a reason why we can't change our mind. And I'm going to say this very carefully, too. I think we should give our children reasons for our answers when we can. That does not mean that every time they get an answer, a reason. Sometimes because I said do it is a good enough reason. Because sometimes you're training your children to accept the authority of the parents and of the home. And I told you to do it, and that's why you're going to do it. However, if we're saying, no, you can't go to the movie Friday night, maybe it's okay to say, because we have family plans, or, you know, I've asked you to do 5 things this week, and you didn't do any of them, so no, you don't get the reward of doing that. To have a reason, I think, is reasonable whenever you can. Because sometimes the reason is because I said so, because I am the parent, and you need to learn that you have to do what I tell you to do. But as children get older, I think they need more reasons to help them understand. And it's a way of teaching. You know, if we are just autocratic and they never know when they come to us what the answer is going to be, they have no way of anticipating our move, our reaction. That's a very uncomfortable way to live. It's actually one of the things that can poke people over to mental illness if they have some problems anyway. If they live in an unsure and uncertain world where they don't have a foundation of kind of an expectation, that's a very dangerous way to rear children, and it can cause them great harm. So to just, and I've heard people say, well, I just want to keep them on their toes. Keeping people off balance mentally and emotionally is dangerous and abusive. And I don't think we have the right to do that. Doesn't mean we have to kowtow to our children. We're the adults. We're in charge. Amy?
It can keep your children out of danger, too, if they do know what to expect from you.
Right.
My children, I mean, Erica will tell you, she tells people at work, no, my mother wouldn't let me do that.
Yeah.
And she says that right up front. She doesn't have to call me and ask first.
Right, because she knows.
And so what's happened is, and I've told my children this, if you're in a situation where you're uncomfortable, you know, because kids are young, it's a lot of pressure to say, no, I'm a Christian, I don't feel like I should do that.
Right.
That's hard on them at their age. Now, we want them to grow to that point where they can do that on their own. But you can blame me for now.
Absolutely.
And that's an out for you. No, my mother wouldn't let me.
Right.
And so she knows. I won't let her do it.
Yeah.
You know.
I told my kids the same thing. Blame me. I don't care.
There are things like I don't mind, like I don't mind standing up for God in the way of just being like, if it's like a party, I can say no, I won't do that stuff. Like they're having this work party and there was alcohol there, and I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not gonna go there.
Right.
But like the ones Mom referring to is just like if a friend invites me to movies, I know it's an automatic no. I don't go socialize with people outside of the church really, other than workforce.
Not to go to a movie.
But that's the only case where it's.
Well, I think it's important that children be able to use us as an out. And I agree with you. I remember in high school, people finally quit asking me to go to the parties where alcohol was because I wouldn't go, and they knew why I wouldn't go. And I told my kids, I said, it gets easier if you just say, I don't do that, because eventually they get tired of asking you, and they'll leave you alone. Whereas if you waffle around and go, well, not this time, then that says to them, okay, I can keep trying, I can keep poking. So if you just say it up front, you help yourself. But if any time you need to, blame me, because I don't care. It's okay with me. Amy?
That goes back to the section that we did in the beginning, the Choose You This Day. You know, there was a man in Rhode Island who was, you know, a strong man in the church there, and that was one thing that he talked about with attendance, is if you make that decision once, that every time the doors are open, I am going to be there,
you don't go through the stress of, should we go to the baby shower that's,
right.
you know, Sunday right. morning or not? Or should we go to that brunch our relatives are having? Or, oh, our cousin's coming into town. We haven't seen him in 5 years. Should we go to church or not? Mm-hmm. You've already solved the problem. There is no question. Right. There is no stress. You're going to church. You can invite them to come. You can say, I'll sure. be there afterward. But the decision's been made once for all, and it's the same with these other issues right. with our children. If you've established a plan, then the decisions are made and the stress is over.
Right. This friend I've told you all about that is not interested in anything religious, but we travel together and work sometimes. And she knows that when we're out of town, if we're there over Wednesday night, I'm going to go to services. And Roger said, will she go with you? And I said, oh, no. He said, will you invite her? Sure. Every time. She'll say no, but every time I'll invite her. And the last couple of times, it hasn't been quite so strident. It's things like, you don't want to hear me sing. You know, so maybe we're making some ground. But it's not a question of, because we often, if we're out of town working, we work at night in our hotel rooms. We grab food in there and we're working till midnight. But she knows on Wednesday night, I'll just have to wait till I get back. And like you said, it's not a decision we have to make every time. We don't have to talk about it every time. It's just this is what we're doing.
We talked a lot about these strategies as applies to older children. I think a lot of this stuff can also be applied in different ways to younger children. I know I use questions with my kids all the time. And since they're younger, a lot more of the focus on why we do something is obedience, especially at the times when they're testing their boundaries and it's all I don't want to.
Yes.
But, you know, and then you, you know, focus more on the obedience aspect. But if it's something especially I can tell is bothering them about it, I like to go back later. It's like, why do you know why you got in trouble? Do you know why you couldn't do this?
Right.
And then when they're not in that mode of, you know, going against everything, it's, I want you to do this or don't do that. And they're like, why? I'm like, well, why do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Or, if you do this, what do you think is going to happen?
Right. Prediction is a really important piece of this.
So I think that, and I've been doing that for a couple of years, I think, you know, you have to kind of modify it more, probably more a little toward the obedience side than you would maybe with the older kids. But I think you should start that very young. It lets them work through to the natural consequences
right.
on their own.
Right.
Just equip them to make better decisions.
And actually, in early childhood, when I'm going around teaching people, just the age of your children and a little bit younger, 3, 4, 5. Prediction is a really important thought process. And it's important in a lot of things, even not moral. What do you think will happen if you jump off the brick porch that's 3 feet high? What are the possibilities there? So I think you're really right on that prediction. If you do this after I've told you not to, what do you think could happen? First of all, why did I tell you not to do it? What do you think might happen to you? And then if you do it after I've told you not to, what do you think might happen? What's your prediction?
I think a lot of times people severely underestimate what young children, and even like to the pro-baby class, just so everyone knows. I think they severely underestimate, because kids, they're sponges at that age, even very young. They're learning everything about them. They're learning to speak. They're learning to walk. They can just keep at it.
And
they're equipped to learn.
Their neurons
are
connecting. And if they don't connect, we prune them. We don't have as many neurons as babies have.
Someone told me at one point, I don't remember where they got it, some kind of stat about three-year-olds. However much you think your three-year-old knows, multiply that by 10.
That's probably about right.
Mm-hmm. When my children were little, I started homeschooling when Olivia was 5 and Chris was 4. And so we always had Bible time as part of our school day. And, you know, I would take the Bible and open it. I didn't have a special child age book that
right.
I used. I opened the Bible and I read to them the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I used, you know, picture drawings on a whiteboard, which I'm a terrible drawer. So, you know, for them to get it at all is amazing. But my children at 4 and 5, I didn't even tell them the next part of the parable, but we went through the seed. And when they fell on the different grounds, we'd already talked, and we'd already laid the foundation for the fact that Jesus told stories, and the stories meant something about God. What does this mean? And as I walked them through, my 4-year-old son was answering right on what those different seeds were. And then we said, okay, now we've got our answers. Let's see what Jesus said the answer is. And we went through and read it. And, you know, I was like, look at you. You got this, you know. they're amazing at that age. And I did a lot of what Bonnie was saying. You know, we did a lot of questions. Why do you think you shouldn't? Or if you shouldn't, why not? And, you know, and they're sharp. They understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're very underestimated by the general populace. And all you have to do is spend a few days with a three-year-old to figure it out. So. Thanks, ladies. And once again, we didn't finish the lesson, but maybe next week.